Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features is designed for people learning English. Today, we hear about the 50th anniversary of an important American movie. We also listen to a short segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. Today we hear The Caliph, Cupid, and the Clock by O. Henry. But first, here is Ashley Thompson.
17 people have died after a duck boat overturned and sank in a lake in the Midwestern American state of Missouri. The boat was carrying 29 tourists and 2 crew members. The accident happened on Table Rock Lake in Branson, a tourist area famous for country music shows and other entertainment. Officials blamed the accident on stormy weather. Winds at the time were blowing as hard as 105 kilometers per hour. Missouri State Police said 14 people survived, including 7 who were injured when the boat sank. The boats were first designed for the United States military to transport troops and supplies during World War II. They have the ability to travel on land and in water. The boats were later changed to be used as sightseeing vehicles and renamed duck boats. The Missouri accident is the latest in a series of accidents involving duck boats. More than 30 people have died in such incidents in the last 20 years. 13 people died after a duck boat sank near Hot Springs in the state of Arkansas in 1999. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 2 Hungarian tourists were killed in 2010 when a barge hit a disabled duck boat in the Delaware River. 5 years later, a woman was struck and killed by a duck boat while crossing a Philadelphia street. In 2015, 5 college students were killed and 69 others were injured when a duck boat hit a bus in Seattle, Washington. And in 2016, a duck boat ran over a scooter in Boston, Massachusetts. One woman died and another person was seriously injured. Andrew Duffy works for the law firm that represented the duck boat accident victims in Philadelphia. He called duck boats death traps. He told the Associated Press they are not fit for water or land because they are half car and half boat. Suzanne Smagala is with Ripley Entertainment, which runs the duck boat operation in Branson. She said this was the area's only duck boat accident in more than 40 years of operation. Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board arrived in Branson on Friday to examine the accident. U.S. President Donald Trump extended his sympathies to the victims and their families. He wrote Friday on Twitter, "Such a tragedy, such a great loss. May God be with you all." I'm Ashley Thompson.
It was 50 years ago that the science fiction film 2001, A Space Odyssey, opened in theaters across the United States. The film, directed by Stanley Kubrick, was based on a book by Arthur C. Clarke. The almost three-hour-long movie opened to mixed reviews in 1968. Critics said it was too cerebral and slow to be understood by moviegoers. Today, the movie is one of the American Film Institute's top 100 films of all time. Douglas Trumbull is a movie director. 50 years ago, he was a special photographic effects supervisor in the 2001 production. He describes Stanley Kubrick as a perfectionist who spent 4 years making the film. Trumbull said that Kubrick started out by planning to make the film like other movies, with tensions and excitement building throughout the storyline. But then he began removing all of the usual theatrical elements because he was working on a large 70mm widescreen film. The movie became more immersive, and the more experimental it became, the less you had to talk about, Trumbull noted. To create this experience, Kubrick built what Trumbull calls a centrifuge set, the big centerpiece of the movie. The cameras were tied on the rotating set and were filming in 360 degrees. This is how Kubrick created the images of the astronauts walking from the floor to the top of the spaceship. And then there was the music. "2001: A Space Odyssey" is remembered for its use of classical music instead of music specially created for the film. The music of Johann Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz is in step with Kubrick's slow-moving images of space. And the Richard Strauss work, also Sprach Zarathustra, became a classical hit because of the movie. In 1968, moviegoers watched the film on huge screens with rounded edges in theaters. They walked away with Kubrick's message: life on Earth was aided by intelligent life from outer space. Kubrick did not use well-known images of otherworldly beings. Instead, the alien presence appears suddenly, sending signals that teach ape-like creatures how to use tools for hunting and survival. Millions of years later, in Kubrick's imagined high-tech world of 2001, the aliens make contact again. They urge human beings to explore the planet Jupiter. And they get to Jupiter, and that's where the transformation takes place, said Trumbull. The only astronaut still alive on the spacecraft, Dave Bowman, leaves his body after making contact with the aliens. He enters a stargate, which takes him to another part of the universe. Trumbull takes credit for the special effects that created the film's famous stargate. He also found realistic ways to show the Earth and distant stars. Trumbull compares Kubrick's filming of 2001 to current-day virtual reality filmmaking. You know, he said, the time when the 2001 was made, it was in the time of A Sound of Music, West Side Story, and giant screen theaters, and you would go out. It was a big deal to go out to see a big screen movie. Equally important to the technology is the film's plot. The idea was that some super intelligent civilization way beyond our imagination that to us would look like a god was intervening in human affairs from time to time just to make sure we got through, Trumbull said. The movie explored the relationship between man and machine. Bowman and Hal, the ship's computer, fight for control of the ship. Bowman wins. The film ends with Bowman in a hotel room the aliens have created from his memory so they can contact him. He is a dying old man. He is finally transformed into a star. To celebrate the film's 50th anniversary, artist Simon Birch recreated that hotel room. His model can be seen at the Smithsonian Institution's Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. 2001: A Space Odyssey has been re-released in IMAX theaters across the country to celebrate its 50th anniversary. The movie feels as important now as ever. I'm Susan Shand.
In 1996, a New York City public school teacher who was getting ready to retire wrote his first book. It was a memoir about his tragic childhood in Limerick, Ireland, a childhood just bursting at the seams with misery and alcoholism and poverty.
In economic circumstances, it was desperate. It was Calcutta with rain.
The author, of course, was Frank McCourt, and the book was Angela's Ashes. Getting published at 66 years old was a lifelong dream for McCourt, but he didn't just get published. He won a Pulitzer Prize and became a literary celebrity. It was a stunning turn of events for a humble immigrant. Back in the slums of Ireland, he'd barely had an education, but for some reason, he was always desperate to write.
If they told me to write an essay of 150 words, I'd write 500 words. So the master said, stop, McCourt, stop. That's enough, stop. And then they might read it to the class. Oh, and then, of course, I'd be teased again in the school. Yeah, for Jesus' sake, McCourt, will you stop writing? We have to listen to it.
Well, today we're going to wallow in the sheer joy of listening to Frank McCourt's stories. He tells them as well as he writes them. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the audio vault of the Academy of Achievement. Our hashtag is What It Takes Now. So take a moment and let your friends know you're listening. When Frank McCourt first came to speak at an Academy of Achievement event, he was still adjusting to his new life in the limelight. It was 1999, 3 years after he'd written Angela's Ashes, and the same year the movie version was released. These are the first words Frank McCourt said as he took to the podium.
I'm not here because I was a teacher. I'm here because I wrote a book. 27 years as a teacher, nobody paid me a scrap of attention. Then you write a book about misery, and everybody pays attention, and they ask you for your opinion on things. I've been asked for my opinion on everything. I've been asked to write for various magazines just because I wrote this book. I've been asked to write for Gourmet magazine, and I grew up on bread and tea.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
The Caliph Cupid, and a clock. Prince Michael of Valueluna sat in the park on the seat he liked best. In the coolness of the night he felt full of life. The other seats were not filled. Cool weather sends most people home. The moon was rising over the houses on the east side of the park. Children laughed and played. Music came softly from one of the nearer streets. Around the little park, cabs rolled by. The trains that traveled high above the street rushed past. These cabs and trains, with their wild noises, seemed like animals outside the park. But they could not enter. The park was safe and quiet. And above the trees was the great round shining face of a lighted clock in a tall old building. Prince Michael's shoes were old and broken. No shoemaker could ever make them like new again. His clothes were very torn. The hair of his face had been growing for 2 weeks. It was all colors, gray and brown and red and green-yellow. His hat was older and more torn than his shoes and his other clothes. Prince Michael sat on the seat he liked best, and he smiled. It was a happy thought to him that he had enough money to buy every house he could see near the park if he wished. He had as much gold as any rich man in this proud city of New York. He had as many jewels and houses and land. He could have sat at table with kings and queens. All the best things in the world could be his. Art, pleasure, beautiful women, honor. All the sweeter things in life were waiting for Prince Michael of Valueluna, whenever he might choose to take them. But instead, he was choosing to sit in torn clothes on a seat in a park. For he had tasted the fruit of the tree of life. He had not liked the taste. Here in this park, he felt near to the beating heart of the world. He hoped it would help him to forget that taste. These thoughts moved like a dream through the mind of Prince Michael. There was a smile across his face with its many-colored hair. Sitting like this in torn clothes, he loved to study other men. He loved to do good things for others. Giving was more pleasant to him than owning all his riches. It was his chief pleasure to help people who were in trouble. He liked to give to people who needed help. He liked to surprise them with princely gifts. But he always gave wisely, after careful thought. And now, as he looked at the shining face of the great clock, his smile changed. The prince always thought big thoughts. When he thought of time, he always felt a touch of sadness. Time controlled the world. People had to do what time commanded. Their comings and goings were always controlled by a clock. They were always in a hurry and always afraid because of time. It made him sad. After a little while, a young man in evening clothes came and sat upon a seat near the prince. For half an hour he sat there, nervously. Then he began to watch the face of the lighted clock above the trees. The prince could see that the young man had a trouble. He could also see that, somehow, the clock was part of the trouble. The prince rose and went to the young man's seat. "I am a stranger, and I shouldn't speak to you," he said. "But I can see that you are troubled. I am Prince Michael of Valueluna. I do not want people to know who I am." That is why I wear these torn clothes. It is a small pleasure of mine to help those who need help. First, I must feel sure they are worth helping. I think you are. And perhaps your trouble may be ended if you and I together decide what to do about it. The young man looked up brightly at the prince, brightly, but he was still troubled. He laughed then, but still the look of trouble remained. But he accepted this chance to talk to someone. "I'm glad to meet you, prince," he said pleasantly. "Yes, I can see you don't want to be known. That's easy to see. Thanks for your offer to help, but I don't see what you can do. It's my own problem, but thanks." Prince Michael sat down at the young man's side. People often said no to him, but they always said it pleasantly. "Clocks," said the prince, "are tied to the feet of all men and women. I've seen you watching that clock. That face commands us to act, whether or not we wish to act. Let me tell you not to trust the numbers on that face. They will destroy you if they can. Stop looking at that clock. What does it know about living men and women?" "I usually don't look at that clock," said the young man. "I carry a watch, except when I wear evening clothes. I know men and women as I know the trees and the flowers," said the prince warmly and proudly. "I have studied many years, and I am very rich. There are few troubles that I cannot help. I have read what is in your face. I have found honor and goodness there, and trouble. Please accept my help. I can see that you are wise. Show how wise you are. Do not judge me by my torn clothes. I am sure I can help you." The young man looked at the clock again, and his face grew darker. Then he looked at a house beside the park. Lights could be seen in many rooms. 10 minutes before nine, said the young man. He raised his hands and then let them fall as if hope had gone. He stood up and took a quick step or two away. "Remain," commanded Prince Michael. His voice was so powerful that the young man turned quickly. He laughed a little. "I'll wait 10 minutes and then I'll go," he said in a low voice, as if only to himself. Then to the prince he said, "I'll join you. We'll destroy all the clocks, and women too." "Sit down," said the prince softly. "I do not accept that. I do not include women. Women are enemies of clocks. They are born that way. Therefore, they are friends of those who wish to destroy clocks. If you can trust me, tell me your story." The young man sat down again and laughed loudly. "Prince, I will," he said. He did not believe that Prince Michael was really a prince. His manner of speaking proved that. "You see that house, Prince? That house with lights and 3 windows on the 3rd floor? At 6 tonight, I was in that house with the young lady I'm going to... was going to marry. I'd been doing wrong, my dear Prince, and she heard about it. I was sorry. I wanted her to forget it. We're always asking women to forget things like that, aren't we, Prince? 'I want time to think,' she said. 'I will either forget it forever or never see your face again.' At 8:30, she said, 'Watch the middle window on the 3rd floor of this house. If I decide to forget, I will hang out a long white cloth. You will know then that everything is as it was before, and you may come to me. If you see nothing hanging from the window, you will know that everything between us is finished forever. That,' said the young man, "is why I've been watching that clock. The time was past 23 minutes ago. Do you see why I'm a little troubled, my torn prince?" "Let me tell you again," said Prince Michael in his soft voice, "that women are the born enemies of clocks. Clocks are bad. Women are good. The white cloth may yet appear." "Never," said the young man hopelessly. "You don't know Marion. She is always on time to the minute. That was the first thing I liked about her. At 8:31, I should have known that everything was finished. I'm going to go west. I'll get on the train tonight. I'll find some way to forget her. Good night, Prince." Prince Michael smiled his gentle, understanding smile. He caught the other's arm. The bright light in the prince's eyes was softening. It was dreamlike, clouded. "Wait," he said, "till the clock tells the hour. I have riches and power, and I'm wiser than most men. But when I hear the clock tell the hour, I'm afraid. Stay with me till then. This woman shall be yours. You have the promise of the Prince of Valleluna. On the day you are married, I will give you $100,000 and a great house beside the Hudson River. But there must be no clocks in that house. Do you agree to that?" "Sure," said the young man. "I don't like clocks." He looked again at the clock above the trees. It was 3 minutes before nine. "I think," said Prince Michael, "that I will sleep a little. It has been a long day." He lay down on the seat, as if he had often done it before. "You'll find me on this park on any evening when the weather is good," said the prince. "Come to me when you know the day you'll be married. I'll give you the money." "Thanks, prince," said the young man. "That day isn't going to come, but thanks." Prince Michael fell into a deep sleep. His hat rolled on the ground. The young man lifted it, placed it over the prince's face, and moved one of the prince's legs into an easier position. "Poor fellow," he said. He pulled the torn coat together over the prince's body. It was nine. Loud and surprising came the voice of the clock, telling the hour. The young man took a deep breath and turned for one more look at the house. And he gave a shout of joy. From the middle window on the third floor, a snow-white, wonderful cloth was hanging. Through the park, a man came hurrying home. "Will you tell me the time, please?" asked the young man. The other man took out his watch. 8:29, and then he looked up at the clock. "But that clock is wrong," the man said. "The first time in 10 years, my watch is always—" But he was talking to no one. He turned and saw the young man running toward the house with three lighted windows on the third floor. And in the morning, two cops walked through the park. There was only one person to be seen, a man asleep on a long park seat. They stopped to look at him. "It's Michael, a dreamer," said one. "He's been sleeping like this in the park for 20 years. He won't live much longer, I guess." The other cop looked at something in the sleeper's hand.
"Look at this," he said. $50. I wish I could have a dream like that."
And then they gave Prince Michael of Valleluna a hard shake and brought him out of his dreams and into real life.
And that is our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.